When you live in a place where little water falls from the sky during the growing season, you have to plan ahead for your obtaining and use of water. Southern Oregon and Northern California, inland anyway, are in similar boats, if you'll pardon the expression. We'll focus on California today, which has a huge history of water issues up to the current day and absolutely into the future. The issues are addressed region by region in a unique book called Water More or Less, filled with essays, photography, and art. We'll talk to the two creators of the book today. Rita Schmidt-Sudman is a longtime journalist with an Emmy Award among her honors. She's also the former executive director of the Water Education Foundation. Rita, thanks for joining us.
I'm delighted to be with you.
Good to have you here. Stephanie Taylor is with us as well. She is fluent in several art forms, including painting, sculpture, and photography. And when pictures won't do, she resorts to words for newspaper opinion pieces and several of the essays in this book as well. Stephanie Taylor, thank you for joining us.
Good morning, Jeffrey. It's a pleasure.
Pleasure. Rita, tell us about the birth of the project and what you set out to do here.
Well, I have quite a bit of time, as you noted.
Okay, Rita, that's not going to work. We have a real echo on your phone line. So,
we'll try to reestablish contact with you.
Is
it okay now?
Oh, yeah, that's better. Yeah.
All right. I've just moved to another room, so I don't have eye contact with Stephanie, but I think we can manage.
Okay.
So I had been in water for many years, and when I retired, it was in the middle of the drought in California, affected you guys too, and I just felt at a loss, like I was quitting at a time when it was a time where all these things were happening, and I knew Stephanie, and Stephanie said, why don't we sit down and write a book? Let's make it something different where we have some of the beauty and interest in water through the art and other things like that, and you do some of the opinion pieces, and then I'll do some of the pieces about real people, like a fisherman and a farmer. And so we kind of tossed it around a little and decided that this would be a book that maybe actually we could get the public to be interested in and to read. And with Stephanie's beautiful art, it seems like we've hit on something.
Stephanie, give us an idea of the layout of the book and the general shape of it.
Well, it's based on a simple graphic form with an emphasis on the art, because there are a lot of wonky books about water, and we thought that the art and photography could bring in a visual interest. So I designed a border for each of the three themes, which is Rita's contributions in essays over her 34 years of experience in water. My essays have a different border, and then the 20 contributors who we were so wonderfully lucky to get have yet a third border. And so it's a very simple layout and based on, you know, the geographic watershed regions.
All right. And Rita, when we talk about the 20 other voices here, the 20 diverse voices, as you put it, is no joke. I mean, we even have the Westlands Water District represented in here, which is a name known in our part of California for its opposition, for example, to additional water releases into the Trinity River to help the salmon and the Klamath.
Well, that's right. The water agencies and the water districts and the whole water industry is very conflicted, and you have everything from soup to nuts. And certainly the Westlands Water District is an area that was put into farming in the 40s and 50s and then got state water. And it's on the west side of the San Joaquin Valley, and it's an area that naturally has no water. And a lot of people say, well, there's salinity problems there, and they maybe shouldn't have ever farmed there. And in reality, they're getting less and less water, so farming may not continue in that area, but it's been very controversial, some of the areas. You know, in Oregon and California, years ago, we had the idea, oh, you put all the land into farming. You know, you fish out the oceans and you put all the land into farming, and now we're finding out that that just doesn't work quite everywhere. And Westlands is one of those areas that's undergoing cropping change and different things that are going on. But certainly the 20 people that are contributors to the articles in our book are from all points of view. And really, as you know, in the West, it breaks down. There are the environmentalists, there are the cities, and then there are the farms. And those three are often in conflict. And once in a while, they can partner and get something done together. And so we've seen some of that. But certainly, those are the 20 voices that are within the book, because those are the players in California water and in Western water.
Well, and there's obviously diversity in landscape across California. As you point out, the book does go by geographic sections. But even between the two of you, Stephanie, tell us about the differences in your backgrounds and the water landscapes you grew up in.
Well, I grew up in Sacramento right at the confluence of these two rivers and spent a lot of time on the American River up in the foothills right near where Sutter discovered gold. And also at Tahoe. So, and then in Southern California, I lived four blocks from the beach for 18 years practically. And so I spent a lot of time down there, commuting with nature and walking the beaches and then moving back to Sacramento again, right along the American River. It was just such a treat.
Rita, you've been covering water issues for a very long time, you mentioned, and you say there's no normal in California. What does that mean, there's no normal in water in California?
Well, there is no average year. There is no normal year. It really just goes back and forth. We don't know when we're going to have the dry years, and we don't know, you know, when we're going to have the wet years. We're learning a little more to look at long-term climate change now, but really, it is unpredictable, and so all these allocations are made every year through the federal and the state and local projects to release certain amounts of water. So now, talking about growing up, I grew up by Camp Pendleton, a Marine Corps base in Southern California. Southern California gets like 9 inches of water a year. There would be no Southern California. Now, I know, listeners, you're saying that's probably a good thing. But in reality, these things do happen, and people seem to like to go where the good weather is, and I guess that's where the Marines decided to have that base, and that's how my dad got there, and that's how we lived there. But it really is a place in the West where even in Oregon you have places that are very dry and water is developed for farming, etc. So we can talk about the controversies of doing this kind of thing, but this is the way the state developed. And in the case of Southern California, where I grew up, water was brought in from the Colorado River.
A lot of hauling of water from place to place in California, one of the many topics we'll talk about as we continue with Rita Schmidt-Sudman and Stephanie Taylor. Their book is Water More or Less. We'll come back to the Jefferson Exchange with the authors and you in a minute five. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We are talking about water in California today. Always an interesting issue, made even more interesting through this unique book in front of me called Water More or Less, which is not just essays from the authors and from a number of people involved in the water business in California, but also it is sprinkled throughout with paintings and photographs as well. Stephanie Taylor comes to this as an artist, Rita Schmidt-Sudman as a longtime journalist covering water issues in California. You can join us on the Exchange, 800-838-3760 by phone, by email jx@jeffnet.org. Rita, Joan Didion receives a dedication in the book. What's her role in California water?
Joan Didion grew up in the Sacramento area, and she always describes her life as a kid on the watch on the rivers in the winter for the floods and the clanging of the pipes in the summer. So she really lived with water and experienced in those days the lack of water and the excess of water and how it could affect a town like Sacramento, which could suffer from flooding and droughts. And as she became a great writer, when I moved to Sacramento, I thought, I just want to be in touch with her. She writes so movingly about California water. She wrote an essay called Holy Water in her book, The White Album. I highly recommend it to people because even though it was written years ago, she just describes her fascination with moving water across the state. She certainly cares about the environment, too. So I thought she was a role model, and I wrote to her as I was a young journalist getting involved in water issues, and she wrote back and we have corresponded through the years. And so we dedicated the book to her because she is an inspiration as a writer, and she's just very poetic in how she talks about water, but she really gets it because she understands the different needs for water.
Stephanie Taylor, you write in the book that that you're not a water expert. You don't even like to swim. You're not a scientist. was this a real journey of discovery for you to go and collect the materials for your part of this book?
Well, my career as a painter, I've always done a lot of research, and I have a history degree from UCLA, so I have a deep curiosity. And so it's such a treat to go out in an immersive environment and meet the biologists and the farmers and the people who are actually working in water every single day, get time with them, make them stop whatever they're doing, as in the case of the Dungeness crab fishermen, and listen to them. It's lots of wonderful stories come out, and sometimes heartbreaking stories.
I want to hear about your work in Norway and its effect on your water views.
Well, I didn't actually work. My ancestors, my grandmother's from Norway, and she came to America at age 16 with no English. Her daughter went to Cal and graduated from Cal. But I went over in 2000 to a big family reunion of 150 wonderful Norwegians, two of whom are professional artists, so I immediately bonded with them. And then some of them are scientists, and we went up to the glaciers, and we followed the water drop by drop, literally followed the water all the way down into the streams and the rivers and the lakes. And when I first saw Strinn, the Strinn Lake and Strinn Valley, where my grandmother was born, I cried. It's just so gorgeous.
But it really is amazing to watch things melting up there in the high country and then come down and watch it all reach the ocean.
Well, my cousin, one of the artist cousins, had called me in 2007 or 6, actually, and he said, "You better get over here. That glacier's melting." And so I went in 2007 and began a body of work for an entire year making sculpture about water.
Rita, there's an introduction in the book from Kevin Starr, who talks about John Wesley Powell and his water warning. So who times two? Who's Kevin Starr, and what did John Wesley Powell have to say?
Well, Kevin Starr is the California State Historian and a very well-respected guy, and he's written a series called Americans and the California Dream, and he really describes in detail the search for water. That's one of the themes within the founding of the state of California and the state of California's growth. But John Wesley Powell was head of the Geological Survey. He was the first head of that in like the 1870s. He was a one-armed Civil War general who navigated down the Colorado River, fascinating man. And he explored the whole area. And what he told people was, this area cannot be turned into agriculture, as all the sod farmers in Nebraska wanted it to be. He said, this area cannot be turned into agriculture. Beyond this meridian, this certain meridian, there isn't enough water, and irrigation schemes were, he thought, just too crazy. So he really warned against changing the Western landscape. But, of course, nobody listened to him. Mm-hmm. And the promoters from back east, you know, who wanted to, and in truth, a lot of people were searching for some cheap land so they could farm, the immigrants, et cetera. So we came up with the 160 acres. They even had a saying, rain follows the plow, that if you went out to the west and you plowed the land, the rain would come. It's ridiculous. I don't know why people believed it, but they did. But it didn't come, so they had to come up with these big irrigation schemes. And you see them in Oregon, Washington, and California, and the whole west. The whole west is connected, whether we like it or not, by these big irrigation plans. And they were mainly for agriculture. And as we know, they did a lot of damage to fish, but they did create this agricultural abundance that when we drink that wine and you know, eat that pasta and cheese, et cetera, it is California and Oregon agriculture that does that.
Kevin Starr writes that this is California's final opportunity to reinvent itself. It sounds rather dire.
Well, he really has talked about how Californians and really all Westerners have done this reinvention of themselves every generation, that we're not, you know, like Europeans, we're not stuck in a mindset where because our parents did this, we have to do this. And we're really going through a lot of changes. As you know, if you 50 years ago talked about the environmental movement, or even, you know, 35 or 40, people would be like, what are you talking about? That has no value. And so we do reinvent ourselves because we reinvent our thinking. But we're also really innovative. I think Americans, and all people can be if they want to, very innovative. We're not afraid to just let tradition bog us down. And that's what Kevin talks about, is that, you know, we're not, it's not hasta la vista, baby. We're going to reinvent this thing. We're going to change it. We're going to improve things. We're going to learn to save water, or, you know, conserve it in different ways. Not the old way of throwing a brick in a toilet, but modern ways, machines that use less water. We won't throw our water away like we used to. And so that's what Kevin's talking about. We're going to reinvent ourselves, because every generation can do that, and he has faith in the Americans to do that.
I should point out, we don't throw the brick in the toilet tank. It'll break it. So just settle it in gently. Let's put it that way.
Yes, but now don't even do that anymore, because
right,
that's obsolete.
So how different a book might this have been if you'd written it this year? I mean, it's out this year, but I assume it was written last year and the year before, when the drought was really looking bad in California. Might it be slightly different with the El Nino rains of this year, Rita?
Well, not really, because, you know, one season of rain does not break a drought. I mean, yes, we have a semi-normal, but really it's not even that normal this year. And we have to look long-term. We have to look at a few years. So I think we're understanding that we're in a period of climate change, and we're in a permanent drought in a way, because we have to closely look at how we use every drop of water. And that's in the book. And the other thing is, Stephanie and I are able to keep revising the book and do it all the time, because it's more of a print-on-demand now. That's a different way of printing books.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're able to update that. But really, the drought was a big wake-up call. I don't see a couple normal years, if we had normal years, really changing things. I think we're understanding now that we're in a new future.
Mm-hmm. You know, it certainly can change a mood, though, when people hear about Shasta Lake filling up, but that was why the question. We're talking to Rita Schmidt-Sudman and Stephanie Taylor, the co-creators of the book called Water More or Less. It is essays, it is photographs, it is Stephanie's artwork, her painting. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk about California water issues. Maybe you have a story to tell. Maybe you have some questions to ask of our guests. 800-838-3760 is the phone number. Email address is jx@jeffnet.org. Here's a call from Steve and Eugene. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Howdy. Back in the 60s, there was talk about diverting water from the Columbia River down to Los Angeles, and that died a quick death. But I'm wondering if these days there are any grandiose schemes of transporting water miles or thousands of miles or tens of thousands of miles from one end of the country to the other to take care of local problems.
And it does seem to come up every so often. Thanks for the question, Steve. Reed, you want to take that one?
Yes, Steve. I want to tell you, you can rest assured that I'm pretty sure we put that idea to death. There were transbasin discussions. I found an old newspaper where President Kennedy was, you know, killed November 22, 1963, and on the second page it talked about just what you were saying, Steve, diverting this water from the Columbia River to Southern California. Now, we know how popular that's been in Oregon through the years. But in 1968, there was actually a congressional directive passed that we're not even allowing studies to be paid to even look at that. So I think that idea, I really think you can rest assured that idea is dead. Californians know that you guys are not going to go for that, and we have to solve our problem different ways, through conservation, through recycling, through even some desal, et cetera. But taking water from the Columbia in these huge transbay diversions that the engineers just loved, I could just see them sitting there with pencils going, and then we'll take the water from here and move it there. And this transbasin thing is not going to happen. I'm pretty confident that we would have to see the worst mega drought in beyond our generations, and so I don't see that happening.
Well, I remember hearing a lot of ideas of the depths of the drought about maybe we could put water on barges and things like that. All sorts of things seem to crop up at those times. Let me get into the Sacramento Valley section of the book. It's the first of the geographical sections. And Stephanie, you give us a word and picture sketch of the three Shastas. What do you mean, three Shastas?
Well, that's Shasta Lake and Shasta Dam and Shasta Mountain. And from the top of the dam, you look back north to the mountain and across the lake, and then you can also take a tour way down deep in the dam. It's quite stunning, quite stunning.
I can imagine. I love the story about John Muir. What happened to him on Mount Shasta?
Well, would you like me to read a quick section?
Sure.
All right. So this is called The Three Shastas. One fine spring day in 1875, John Muir hiked to the summit of Mount Shasta. In awe, he watched the weather change. How beautiful it is, he said. He was surprised, unprepared for the blizzard that followed, and spent a torturous night surviving between snow and hot sulfuric spring in, quote, the pains of a Scandinavian hell at once frozen and burned, unquote. Muir had hiked to a place the water begins. Snow melts and begins a migration into the cone of an ancient volcano, trickling and filtering through fragments of lava. 50 years later, the snowmelt emerges from the mountain at a park in Shasta City as the headwaters of the Sacramento River, beginning a 447-mile journey as it flows toward the sea. Pristine water gushes from three openings in the rock and pauses in a small pond. At its edge, I watched a fuzzy caterpillar arrive, a symbol of metamorphosis, like the water that has transformed the state from a semi-arid desert into our bountiful Central Valley.
It really is a different state from what it was naturally, given the use of water around the state. Water, More or Less, is the book by Stephanie Taylor and Rita Schmidt-Sudman. And I want to ask you, Rita, about another tale from history in this section about John C. Fremont and why he ended up camping on the Sutter Buttes.
Well, when John Fremont came to California, he happened to pick a time which was one of the really, really rainy years. And the Indians had said, the Great Valley, it will fill up, it will rain, and it will flood. And nobody really believed that, because when you look at the size of our rivers, they're nothing like the rivers you see back east. But indeed, that did happen, and he ended up stuck up on the Sutter Buttes for couple weeks or so before he could get out of there, before the water started draining and he was able to escape. So it's quite a story. It's a state that now we have dams, and we have them in Oregon too, that control the water, but we forget how precarious it was, especially for these earlier settlers, when the water was just so intense there was either flooding or drought. You could depend on it.
Not a lot in between. Yeah, go ahead,
Can I
Stephanie.
Jump in there for one second? I met a wonderful farmer just south, about 20 minutes south of Sacramento, and he lives halfway between High 5 and 99. And he talked about how traumatic his childhood was, because the water table was so high it often flooded. And he said now the water table is 14 feet down, and that was a couple of years ago. So it's not, this flooding is not something that happened way back when. It happened in my youth and can still happen tomorrow.
Yeah, and especially in the 50s, 60s, there were many people killed in floods in California. And then in 1997, we had a major flood and a number of people were killed, including an irrigation district manager's wife was in her house, and she was killed. So flooding is a serious thing, and it's something that we've feared in our state and your state, and we've worked on eliminating that, and pretty much we can control that.
Which is why there are dams and diversions and all the other things that that impede the progress of water, hold it back for a while. The whole history of water regulation in California, you get into this again in the book a bit, Rita. It seems like, given how fast California was populated by people from the east, driving out the Native Americans, that water policy took a while to actually turn into a policy kind of thing.
Well, if the policy was go get it when you can get it, I think that's the policy of water around the West. There was no really understanding or respect for the environment, and there wasn't the thought that if you dammed up these rivers, that it was really going to destroy the salmon fishery. And when they figured out it did, agriculture had more power, and, you know, they wanted to grow first wheat, but then when they realized they could irrigate and grow these fruits and vegetables, ship them east when we had, in the 1870s and 80s, the refrigerated cars, then it really became the haves and have-nots, and we made these decisions on changing the West and bringing this agricultural irrigation, and for good or bad, that has made effects on fisheries and other areas.
There are some visits with farmers in here that you undertake in your portions of the book, Stephanie. Gloria Lopez, a third-generation farmer, really interesting story here. How deep did you get into water policy talking to any of the people who are in agriculture?
Well, there are farmers that are out in their orchards every day, and that issue is so critical. I went back, first of all, I went through great efforts to find the owner of the farm whose orchard had been destroyed, wondering, why is it, as a fourth-generation Californian, I have no idea why someone would destroy this orchard. So went back and interviewed them, and they had just dug a new well on their land to take over for a new almond orchard to grow where their walnut orchard had grown.
All right, so out went the almonds and in came the walnuts. We'll come back and talk more about Water More or Less, the book by Stephanie Taylor and Rita Schmidt-Sudman. They are our guests on the Jefferson Exchange. You can join the conversation. We'll come back to talk more about water with our guests and you in a minute 10. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We are talking today about water in California, which, as we know, is always a compelling topic. It is portrayed in a new book called Water More or Less that combines essays by the two authors with essays by a number of other contributors, 20 contributors involved in water allocation around California, and paintings by Stephanie Taylor. Stephanie Taylor and Rita Schmidt-Sudman are guests on the Jefferson Exchange. You can join us at 800-838-3760. Maybe you have a water story to tell or a question to ask or an observation about trips through California. We'd love to hear those. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. We're just talking about agriculture. And so Rita, you get into talking about rice in California, which I think is probably one of the more controversial applications of water for agriculture, given that rice tends to grow in moist, steamy places, and here it is growing in dry parts of California. How did that all get going?
Well, it got going when we had the gold rush, and there were a lot of Chinese people came to California, and they ate rice. Their diet was rice. And farmers and a lot of people realized that, you know, there was a market for rice, too. They would pay for rice. But you really couldn't bring it all in from the Orient, so we started fooling around with trying to grow it. And a lot of the early ways of growing rice were unsuccessful, but the Sacramento Valley, which is kind of a hard pan soil, could hold that water. And eventually a Japanese UC person did some experimentation and figured out that that could be one of the greatest rice-growing areas of the world. So that's what happened. We started growing rice, and it became a big deal, and it was transferred to, sold to the Orient. In the 1970s, there was a Koreagate scandal in which all this rice was going to these countries, and there were payoffs, et cetera. But the rice industry, just to tell a quick story, got under a cloud because people said, just what you said, Jeffrey, that, you know, this was crazy. So the rice people did a 180, really, because Mark Reisner, who wrote Cadillac Desert, really criticized them. But they asked him to come up in the area. In fact, I introduced them to him. And he started saying, well, you know, maybe you could change some of your practices. To make a long story short, they did change a lot of practices and conservation with water and a number of things. And we still grow a lot of rice, but a lot of the water is reused, and it's more beneficial use. They started doing more things for the birds and the environment and making deals. And so now it isn't such a bad thing. And also, we have all the sushi rice in the United States, like 90% of it comes from the Sacramento Valley. So things have turned around a little bit, but rice is still a big crop up there, and it is still subject to some criticism, but I think they have cleaned up their act a lot.
Given the allocation of some of that land for wetlands and for wildlife refuges, this presents a great opportunity for you, Stephanie, with art supplies in hand. How did you take a look at the wetlands?
Well, it surely has. I used to go up to Gray Lodge wetlands area with my mom, who loved it. I was born in Chico, which is 100 miles north of Sacramento. And we would get out there and see the winter birds. I spent a couple of days with different rice farmers. I've gone out in the fields with them, one in particular, and their practices in the rice industry in general has responded so much from when I was a kid, when they did all the burning of the leftover harvests, which really affected air quality in the valley. Now they are flooding their fields, which brings the entire Pacific Coast Flyway back, and the birds are landing. And what they do, they help the farmers. They walk around in the fields, and they're crushing the leftover harvest. And it's really amazing. And Dr. Moyle out of UC Davis is actually introducing some trout fingerlings into the Yolo County rice fields. And they're growing so much faster, salmon.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's a real empathetic, synergistic cooperation going on now that really bodes hope for the future in some of these other issues of battling stakeholders.
Well, let's get into...
I'd just like to say that I think this is generational, too, because I've been around this business for a long time. And what Stephanie's talking about is people working together. When I first started in this business, a farmer wouldn't talk to an environmentalist. They'd want to kill each other.
Mm-hmm.
And through the years, and I think the Water Education Foundation did a lot in California to bring people to the table, both socially. I tried to get these people to have a drink together and formally meet. And so what we are seeing is, you know, younger people in both farming and both environment and the universities, and they don't want to wear the black hat or the white hat. They want to work together, and they want sushi, they want rice, and they want wine, and they want this to work. So yes, you're going to still have your battles, and believe me, they'll still sue each other, but there are more people working together, and there has been a generational shift.
Well, you know, as you mentioned this, I'm just looking at the quote from David Guy of the Northern California Water Association, who talks about there will continue to be water wars. He leaves no doubt in his mind about that.
Well, right. Part of that is the sheer, let me jump in for a second, the sheer population growth. So,
mm-hmm.
You know, aside from the ag situation, there's just a lot of people demanding a lot of water.
Indeed. And Rita, you had a thought on that, too?
Well, that's right, and we do have quite a bit of exports. You know, California grows 50% of the fruits and vegetables for the nation, and lots of the wine, et cetera. So if we continue to have that kind of agriculture, it will always use a lot of water. Now, they certainly cleaned up their act in the last 20, 30 years, and I think you've probably seen that in Oregon, too, or starting to, where water costs more money, where the environmental laws restrict things, and so water becomes more expensive, so you don't waste it. But the beauty of having this kind of agriculture, but yet trying to keep our fisheries alive, it's a conflict, but it's a rich culture that we have, and we need to do everything we can to protect both fish and farming.
Let us take a call. We have John in Veneta on the line. Welcome to The Exchange with Rita Schmidt-Sudman and Stephanie Taylor, the creators of Water More or Less.
Good morning.
Hi.
I hope I didn't miss something here, but what I wanted to bring up and get a comment from the ladies is, and I believe I heard a show you had, Jeffrey, earlier, back that talked about the primeval underground aquifers and how they are shrinking.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, like the stuff that's happened on top, 10-year droughts and all that's kind of just speck in time. And I'm just wondering if they can reflect on that. As the country as a whole, including California. Thank you.
Yeah,
all
okay.
On the radio.
Right. Fossil water, I think, was the term used when we talked about that before. Rita, why don't you come in on this? Because I know that you do write in the book about subsidence of land that has occurred not just recently in California.
Well, he's definitely right. From the Ogallala Aquifer under Nebraska to California, we've been really bad stewards of our groundwater. I think I can say that honestly. Our idea was just pump it up. You know, if you fly across the country, you'll see through Nebraska those round circles. That's how they farm there, and it's all groundwater. And they've just sucked up the groundwater. And, you know, the groundwater is free. You have to pay the electricity to pump it up. But in places like Nebraska, it's pretty close there. But they are experiencing ruining their aquifer. In California, we've just totally done a bad job, because I think that groundwater was always seen as the bank you could go to when we had the dry years. And if you drive through the valley, the Great Valley, San Joaquin Valley today, you would see all these almond orchards. And you would think, well, where are they getting the water, since the State Water Project and the Federal Water Project can only give them a small percent in this drought time? Well, they're getting it from groundwater. Now, that's okay as a bank where, you know, you're desperate in certain years, but agriculture in recent many years now has depended on that groundwater, and they've sunk it horribly, you know, 30 feet from 1977 in some places to now, another 30 feet in the last few years. And it causes the land to crack. It causes bridges to have to be redone. It's a very, very dangerous thing. And we have really used and depended too much on our groundwater. So to make a long story short, in 2014, we finally passed, California being the last state in the nation to have a groundwater bill that would start to restrict this pumping, because it was so desperate. And I don't think if we had this drought, we could have ever passed this law in California, because I watched many years, and there was no power for the scientists and the government agencies to go against the big farming interests and pass this law. But it did happen, and so now, I don't know, it may be too late, but now in California they have to form these districts and they have to start restricting the groundwater within the next few years. And there's a ray of hope that that could help us. But we have really misused our groundwater.
It is nothing short of amazing that it took California that long to deal with groundwater, because it's been so aggressive in how it deals with water in other ways, too. When you think about the fact you get Trinity River water ending up in the Sacramento instead of the Klamath, Sacramento water ending up in the central aquifer going down the San Joaquin Valley, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. The Owens Valley water ending up in Los Angeles. I mean, California moves water just fine, but doesn't deal much with the water in place, or didn't until that law.
Well, that's the interesting thing is, you know, the engineers love that. And so that they were all on board with that. You know, let's move it all around, and it's a shell game, et cetera. And they did amazing things, both good and bad. But the groundwater was like the sacred. That was my water. The courts had said that, you know, it's underneath your feet. It's your water. It's crazy, but so that was where the farmers knew they could always get that water. If they couldn't get it from the surface water, if there was a drought year or whatever, that groundwater would be there. Well, we just kept pumping and pumping and pumping until we got into this overdraft situation, just like taking too much money out of your bank account. So now we're trying to put it back together. But again, California was the last state in the nation to come up with a comprehensive groundwater law.
So before we get out of here, I want to get into the Delta, because it is so important to the state. You've got the Sacramento and San Joaquin Rivers coming together and heading for the ocean as one. Why is that Delta so important to so much of California?
Because it is the quagmire where much of the water comes together. It's a very important environmental place. But we have made this system where water is supposed to be transferred to Central and Southern California so that those places can kind of exist, both having the agriculture and the people. And we have fought about that area and not wanted to pipe the water through because it would hurt the environment. The folks there don't want to see that happen. And so a lot of forces and political issues come together in this small place where a lot of two-thirds of California's water basically converges. and make it really difficult to make these decisions. And so I have watched five governors struggle with this to varying degrees. I would say that this governor, Brown, his dad was governor in the 60s. He now wants to work through this pipe project around the Delta, or under the Delta, and I would say he's trying to bring forces together to maybe make some compromises and make this work. But I don't know if it will, because the history of California is you get to the Delta and all bets are off.
Indeed. Stephanie, I want to talk about your approach to the Delta, because it is a gorgeous place to look at, so a great place for an artist, but so obviously lots going on in history too. So how did you approach looking at the Delta country?
Well, I went out with a friend on a boat and spent from morning till night just appreciating it. I've been out on canoes, and I also spent a day with a bridge tender. But the thing about the Delta and the San Francisco Bay, and particularly the Delta, it's an incubator for all the little species that are, coming up into the mountains and going back to the sea. And so, and everybody's upset about the Delta smelt. Well, that's kind of like a canary situation. It's a feeder species. So lots of other species eat those little guys. And it's kind of ironic. So that's what the whole concern is. If that little species disappears, what are the next predators in the food chain going to eat? But it's basically such a wonderful incubator for the growth of all these species that depend between the inland and the ocean.
We barely talked about fish today. That could be a whole nother hour, and there's lots to talk about with California Water Always. Stephanie Taylor and Rita Schmidt-Sudman, the co-creators of Water More or Less, reflections about the changing landscape of California's water in stories, art, and policy, including diverse voices from 20 top water leaders. I want to thank you both for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
It's been wonderful to be with you.
A pleasure.